ask to those members from the Select Committee on Finance. The Select Committee on Appropriation has been established, and it was 86 yesterday. Now my role is to elect the chairperson. I will therefore call from the members for the nomination of the chairperson for the Select Committee on Appropriation. Honorable Debir.
Honorable Presiding Officer, I'll propose Honorable Chami as the candidate for this position of chairperson of the Select Committee of Appropriation.
Any second to that name? Honorable Plum.
You know, it's my friend, Mr. Chani, but I want to second it, not to
Honorable Chani has been seconded. Any name for the position of the chairperson of the Select Committee on Appropriation? Honorable Makubela.
Honorable Dibias. The name is proposed.
The name of Honorable Dibier has been proposed. Any second? Honorable Bloom?
I, with all respect, but I decline as the chairperson of the Select Committee on Finance. And in terms of the ATC that was published yesterday, there's an appropriation committee, and we are requested to elect a chairperson for the Select Committee on Appropriation. And if you read the ATC, the designated chairperson is sitting next to me on my left-hand side. It's indicated also in the publicized document. We received it yesterday in our pigeon office.
Chairperson, seeing that the ANC is a bankrupt of leaders, I am volunteering to lead them from Cope side, because I can see that they don't have any more leaders. I am available as a leader of Cope.
Any seconder to that name? Honorable Bloom? Honorable Mohoro?
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Bloom, Chair, I'm sure it's the first time you're chairing a meeting where Honorable Member Bloom is present. You must just take it like someone whose mind, instead of moving forward, his mind is working better. Thank you.
You can see that the Honorable Member is supporting my name. That's why he's doing this. So you can declare that I'm the chairman.
Since there is no other name, I therefore declare Honorable Chani the chairman of the Select Committee on Appropriation. You may come forth and ask the rest of the committee.
Thank you, Chair. I don't have much to say except to say thank you very much for the vote of confidence in me from members, and in particular from the African National Congress. I don't have any speech. I just want to thank you for appointing me as the chairperson of the new appropriation committee. And in light of the fact that there's still some proceedings with the finance committee issues, I would like to say thank you very much.
Members, thank you. Welcome at the meeting of the Select Committee on Finance. We eventually progress there where we have the Select Committee on Appropriation as well, after lots and lots of deliberations. But welcome to every member here present. We're dealing with one item today, and that is the annual report of the Finance Fiscal Commission. we all know Dr. Setai, he was here when we started in Parliament as new members of Parliament, also in the NCP, when they did their introduction, a briefing of what they do. That was quite a while ago. So we're going to give them, Dr. Setai, the opportunity to introduce his team, and then straight get into the business of this afternoon to do their presentation. I request also, honorable members, that you again have a look at your committee program. Now, from now on, there will be two programs, one for the Select Committee on Finance and one for the Select Committee on Appropriation. So we will have to be vigilant from now on. Who's going to deal with what? But on Friday morning, we are dealing with our oversight report, the oversight to Mpumalanga. At the previous meeting, we requested honorable members to make a written input on the report, specifically on your recommendation. What do you think is a solution in terms of the issues we dealt with, the seven municipalities when we visited Mpumalanga, in Ermelo and in Nelspruit? And please, as soon as possible, submit it to Mr. Rentu, our secretary, to compile it, to dovetail it, and circulate it to you before Friday. So when we get to the meeting on Friday, we could have done some homework and make the adjustments, amendments to the report, because it must also go to the House. The other report will be about the hearings we had on the FFC's recommendation, when we called in the provinces as well, departments. So we will deal with that. Will it be ready, Mr. Enter? It will be ready. Then the third one is, the third report will be on the quarterly spending of conditional grants by different provincial departments. You will recall we called in provinces, sports, arts and culture, public works, it was health, etc. So that report we will also deal with to complete it before we go on recess the 20th of November. So that will be our program. And then next week, the 3rd and the 4th of November, is a public hearing on the MTPBS, where we will call in stakeholders from the public as well as economists to come and make their inputs. That's next, the 3rd and the 4th of November. Will it be in this venue? I can't recall. In the Goodall Chamber. In the Goodall Chamber, that's next week. So you will have to look at your programs. That is a commercial we are passing on to you members. Check your pigeon notes, check your mail, check your programs. Dr. Setai, over to you. Welcome. Introduce your team and you can get into your annual report.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. To my immediate left, it's Bongani Khumalo, the Deputy Chair of the FFC. Of course, my name is Bethel Setai, Chair of the FFC. And then we are supported by members of the Secretariat. To my extreme left, Mabuso Mokwane, he is the CFO. And then behind him is Mashumi Zaidume, he is the executive director. And then Henry Eckstein manages our Cape Town office and is always available for whatever contact or queries that may be needed by the members. We are reporting today on the annual report of the FSC 2008 to 2009. And the way we are going to report is, initially I will give the background of the FFC, basically its profile, and then thereafter the achievements of the FFC, and then we'll have the final financial report, and then I'll come in again to give to talk on challenges. So I'll do the profile, and I'll then ask Bongani Khumalo, Commissioner, to highlight the achievements, and then I'll come back and talk on the challenges. In terms of the profile, the commission consists of the chairperson, who is also chief executive and accounting officer of the commission. And then the other one is a deputy chairperson, who is a full-time commissioner, and then seven other commissioners. The chairperson, deputy chair, and two other commissioners are nominated by the national executive. And then three commissioners are nominated by the premiers of provinces, and two commissioners are nominated by organized local governments. All appointments are made by the president. The chairperson and deputy chairperson are full-time, as I already indicated. All other commissioners are part-time. One vacancy exists as of July 2009, and we are still awaiting the selection of that person. The terms of office of current commissioners are as follows. Chairperson, appointed from September 2005 to August 2010, next year. The deputy chair and two other non-executive commissioners, March 2008 to February 2013. Four non-executive commissioners, July 2009 to June 2014. That sort of just highlights the purpose of the commission, just to highlight the vision. Is to enhance the developmental impact of public resources through the financial and fiscal system in South Africa. Also, next slide, please. Yeah. The mandate of the Commission, of course, is established in terms of Section 220 of the Constitution, as amended. The Constitution provides, among others, that the Commission is an independent, objective, impartial, and unbiased advisory institution to Parliament, provincial legislatures, organized local government, and other organs of state on the division of revenue among the three spheres of government and any other financial and fiscal matters. That slide highlights the enabling legislation. I won't go through it. The next slide, please, and then those commission achievements, basically, and I'll hand over to my colleague to highlight those.
Thank you, Dr. I think where I must start is basically by just driving the members to the key outputs that are expected of the commission, at least by legislation. We have to table every year, 10 months before the minister tables the Division of Revenue Bill. It's a submission on recommendations for the Division of Revenue for that particular forthcoming year. For example, for 2010-2011 financial year, we've tabled our recommendations, and those were shared with the committee. I think it must have been sometime in August, if I'm not mistaken. So we've tabled those in May already. That's the one submission that's required from the intergovernmental fiscal relations act in terms of that. We also, in terms of that same act, must table a submission on the Division of Revenue Bill itself, which basically is a conversation with what the Commission tables in terms of its recommendation and what then comes out of the consultation processes with the Minister of Finance when he tables the Division of Revenue Bill. So we have to table that every year as soon as the Minister has tabled the bill. So we must come and share that with the committee. And then obviously, the other one, which is required by law, is the annual report, which is what we're talking about today. There are other submissions that we must make during the course of the year upon request, and those are made in terms of the Financial and Fiscal Commission Act, and also other pieces of legislation as listed in an earlier slide that the chairperson. The picture, but
those are pieces of legislation that require the commission to, or give a mandate for the commission to comply. So in terms of all of that, I think our achievements are basically found in the fact that we have basically complied. We have also timeously done performed those responsibilities in spite of some of the challenges that the Commission faces that the Chairperson will highlight at the end of this presentation. I think among some of the major achievements, one can look at the areas of research that the Commission has identified for itself. And again, I must say that it does get increasingly difficult to do everything in the face of the challenges that we face. And as I say, the Chairperson is going to come to that. Now, what we have done basically is that in response to the needs of our major stakeholder, which is Parliament and also government departments, is that with every submission that we table in terms of our annual recommendations, we also table a separate document that contains the technical work that actually goes into informing those recommendations of the Commission, so that people or all stakeholders are able to engage with both the content of the recommendations and also the technical information that basically goes into creating that. And the other achievement that we think we can pride ourselves about is that we have been able to develop models within the Commission itself that we actually use for technical analysis. And we have shared some of those models with the Parliament and some government departments, obviously relating here to the past administration. We have run workshops with the parliamentarians, members of the finance committees. So those are the previous finance committees before that preceded this particular committee. We have also made a commitment, basically, to do the same kind of provide the same kind of training to parliamentarians on an ongoing basis, and we do share with some provinces some of the work that we actually do on an ongoing basis, and we have done that with provinces such as the Free State and Limpopo, just sharing our analytical tools with them, and we think that's a very good achievement that is worth noting. I think also in terms of our own internal processes from a corporate perspective, there's been issues raised in the past in relation to our systems, and both from an internal and an external audit point of view, and we have basically successfully managed to address some of those issues. Let me say most of those issues have actually been addressed, and I think when we get to those sections of this presentation, you will probably pick up some of those issues that have been raised that we've dealt with. We have established a risk management framework, which is one area that had been raised as a particular issue of concern in the past, and we have managed to put that together. Let me just talk a little bit about some of the recommendations that we have actually made. Well, some of the recommendations and the areas in which we've made recommendations where we think we have made an impact in terms of responses that we have gotten from the government, basically through the Minister of Finance. We have dealt with issues around the financing of education in terms of dealing with no fee schools.
And I think the recommendations that were made there that basically require a more focused targeting of learners rather than simply looking at where learners come from, but looking at the actual socio-economic position of learners and therefore targeting them in that way in order to ensure that we actually get the right people or the correct people that we want to actually target through those kinds of programs. And I think this is a recommendation that has been accepted by government. We are aware of work that is being done by the Department of Education in terms of perfecting these kinds of mechanisms for targeting learners. With respect to healthcare, I believe that in the year and the report, one of the key recommendations that we made had to do with looking at how we actually account for resources when they go to the areas where they are actually supposed to go. So at the hospital or at the clinic level, we basically managed to make a recommendation that was accepted and is now part and parcel of the Division of Revenue Act, which basically requires that information around financing be reflected and gazetted at least at the level of the healthcare centers, for example, clinic and hospitals. There is obviously a gap there because in certain instances you find that your clinics still fall under municipalities, and even though the function basically is a provincial function in terms of primary health care, they might find that there's still some gaps in that respect because of the disjuncture in your financial years and all of that. So in certain instances, municipalities actually provide primary health care services on behalf of government. Of provincial government, so in to try and realign that so that we are able to see what the allocations going to a specific clinic are would probably take a little bit of time because you've got to align the municipal financial year or at least the process gets reflected in the municipal financial year so that you are able to pick that up. But I think that's something that one is working around, and I think government has welcomed that kind of a recommendation. With respect to the issue of housing delivery, we have made a recommendation, and we basically are happy with the response of government that there is a review around the powers and functions of provinces and local government, but we still believe that there is actually a need to speed up the process of accrediting municipalities to actually deal with some of the uncertainties associated with the delivery of housing. And lately we talk about human settlements, and that even makes it more imperative that one links what municipalities do and what provinces actually do in terms of making sure that when you deliver houses, you're actually taking into account the concept of a settlement, because it's not just the four walls and the foundation that constitute the house, but it's a whole range of other services that mostly reside with municipalities, and where you have municipalities that have the capacity, it being government policy or agreed government policy that you can accredit some of these municipalities to do that. And invariably, these are municipalities that would tend to be more urbanized, and therefore that is where your demand for housing and in the form of settlements is actually highest. So we need to look out for that, and progress with that is something that the Commission is consistently looking at. There are issues around local government revenue that are beginning to take center stage, and I think the work of the Commission in general here, I would say, the recommendations that were made in the last cycle basically related to the augmenting of revenue sources for municipalities, and emphasizing the need to ensure that if you introduce revenue raising powers for municipalities actually need to have sufficient control of those revenue sources, both in terms of determining the tax base and also in terms of setting the tax rate, because it's an issue of accountability. In most cases, municipalities must raise revenue from people residing within the jurisdiction, and the point around linking the revenue source to accountability is that people immediately must see the benefit of the taxes that they actually pay. So I wouldn't like to be seen to be paying my property rates and then find that my streets are not cleaned and lights are not working, there's no security, but you are paying all of those things. So those things get very visible at a local level. And if you have a disjuncture around that, it becomes very difficult to manage issues of accountability or assign accountability where they said delivery failure in the face of people actually paying their rent. So it's an issue that we think is very important, and in terms of looking both at replacing the RSC levies that were abolished two years ago, basically. I think this recommendation followed on that abolition of the RSC levy. So this is an issue where we think the commission has made a significant contribution, and it's an issue that we're still grappling with. There is an issue around the electricity pricing, generation and distribution, which the commission has done a lot of work on. And government basically agrees with the initial recommendations coming out from the commission, but obviously there's been a lot of developments in the intervening period, which basically when we think about it today and we thought about the kind of work that we did, the kind of simulation exercises that we did at that time, I think Dr. Sadai, we even simulated a situation where electricity prices increased by 100%. And looked at what the impact of that would be on the economy and what it would be on the different groups of people. And we basically found that there would basically be a need for government to intervene directly to protect the poor and the vulnerable in terms of that. So I think we have made a contribution in that, and I think it's an achievement under the circumstances, basically. In terms of our submission on the division of revenue bill, now that was on the division of revenue itself to say, but now on the division of revenue bill directly, there have been issues that are of a strategic nature that the commission has raised, which we actually think are issues that in raising those, we're basically trying to alert government and our stakeholders of certain impediments that might actually arise if certain decisions are not taken. And I think these are areas where policy decisions are taken and then the implementation basically stalls. And one such area is the area of the electricity distribution industry. I think the process has actually taken such a long time to such an extent that at this point in time we're basically dealing with constitutional amendments that must actually try and fast-track that process, and that constitutional amendment will still require some enabling legislation to allow government to move ahead with restructuring the electricity distribution industry. And in terms of the current environment in which the electricity sector finds itself, that creates its own internal problems. And so these are areas that we think we'll be raising certain points about having to look at it. There's an issue around conditional grants where we think that the more conditional grants we actually have in the system, there is obviously a trade-off with the equitable share. basically. That's one key issue of concern. The also conditional grants also introduce their own incentive effects within the intergovernmental fiscal relations system and can actually capitalize the way in which a department spend money on a particular program. There are grants, for example, where if one looks at the numbers, you could see a direct substitution effect that actually happens. If we take an example of conditional grants that deal with the infrastructure grants that like that just come from outside of a province. What then happens? No, let me take the easiest one. I think the easiest one that we have tried our best to actually look at is the school nutrition program. What you have is a situation where this grant is meant to sensitize the province to be able to provide school nutrition for school children. And in certain instances, one expects that it will supplement, it can be supplemented by a province on allocation as one moves forward. So you find that as you increase the allocation of that grant, what happens is that the contribution from the province's own revenue, which is the equitable share in most cases, basically declines. So you're having a trade-off. Now, you don't want a substitution effect. You don't want, ideally, you don't want to have that because ultimately one would expect that these kinds of programs can be institutionalized within the provincial budget and then you can actually just put it through the equitable share and then let the province budget for those programs. So it becomes difficult to do those kinds of things. And as you increase these grants, then there's a tendency that that actually might actually happen as we move forward. And so these are issues. There's an issue around capacity building grants. I think capacity, even in the last week, I mean, one was listening to the issues coming out of the meetings with the mayors that the president had, and capacity tends to be quite a big issue. But if we were to look backwards and take stock of how much money we've actually spent on capacity building programs in one form or another, and then evaluate where we are at with that capacity building, we might find that there's quite a lot of money that we have basically thrown away to waste and we haven't benefited anything. So there's an issue around reviewing the way in which we build and we finance and build our capacity. I think in terms of other submissions that we made, we've got a list of submissions there. I think the only piece of legislation where we made a submission that says no, we probably don't need the kind of legislation as it was around the financial management of Parliament Bill. I think the Commission looked at it, and from the Commission's perspective, this had to be done at least in the context of the review of the Public Finance Management Act. The outcome basically was that the bill was the bill had been enacted. So, but the Commission was opposed to that one. Yes, there are other areas basically. I think that I have already touched on that relate to corporate issues within the Commission itself. These are some of the highlights in terms of the achievements.
Can I just tell you something? Obviously, can you just go through the financial?
Thank you, I'm the CEO for Financial and Fiscal Commission, and also for one. My presentation is to just focus on the financial statements of the Commission, both emphasizing on the statement of financial performance and financial position. Starting with the overall performance of the Commission, we've got an unqualified audit report at the end of this year. There were no matters of emphasis with Auditor General. I must also indicate our revenue, the total revenue that we receive from the government. 99% of that revenue comes from the government. The 1% is just the interest that we normally receive from the bank based on the revenue that we receive from the allocation. The current revenue that we received in 2009-10 financial year, I mean 8-9 financial year, was 26.1 million. And out of that revenue, how it was spent, that revenue, most revenue, like human resource-based institution, most of the revenue goes to personnel costs and also operating expenses that run the commission and also the professional services. Starting with the operating expenses, the major cost drivers on the operating expenses are the offices that we rent as a commission. We also do a lot of publications that is normally part of our technical reports that we produce, and also the traveling that is done by the researchers that travel all over the provinces. And also we've got other minor administration issues like your IT and other operating expenses. In terms of the financial performance and positions of the FSC, when you look at the allocation of the revenue that indicated earlier on, which is also one of our challenges, our revenue costs have been decreasing. If you see comparative 2008 and 2009, we received 26.1 compared to 27.4, which is a 5% decrease. These are some of the challenges that you might have. You also understand some of the economic constraints that the government is having. And also, the other challenge we see, the staff cost has come down from 16.1 million to 15.1 million, which is also a major challenge with the FSC because of the high-skilled employees that we have within the and the competition that you normally receive, especially around the public sector, which normally take most of our research staff. That turnover specifically happens on the core business of the FSC. We also look comparatively when we look down on other, like the depreciation, there's been a decrease on depreciation of 10%, given that there was no acquiring of any assets within, both given the budget constraints that we have, and also we've got all assets that have been sitting with us. And the increase that you see there is on the professional fees. The professional fees is comprised of the technical people that the commission used for researching, and also the major one, also the audit fees. Audit fees comprise 5% of our total budget, which we feel is too high. There's been quite a jump on the audit fees. If you look on our financial statement, you'll see the details under note number, note under 11, when you, on page 58, when you look at what we paid in the previous financial year in terms of the audit fees and what we're paying now. For Auditor General, we paid 1,057 in the previous year, now we're paying 584. And also, we also have the other obligations like the internal audit fees. And when you look at the operating expenses have moved down from 8.2 to 6.9. I think one of the major issues was what was highlighted by the Deputy Chair in terms of the student cost-saving mechanism that we put in place and the improvement that we have done in terms of our internal control system. And obviously that we try to manage the little budget that we have to make sure that we reduce some of the operating expenses, although that has got some negative effects in terms of other issues like our CAPEX. And our asset base, as indicated, that has also decreased by 19%. We haven't been acquiring assets also for the past 3 to 4 years, given the budget constraint that we have, especially currently IT is one of our challenges in terms of the operation. And our liabilities have increased by 7% compared to last year. You see, in terms of the liabilities, we normally have, because of the work cycle, that is not in line with the financial year end, but we normally try to address that at the end of the financial year. And then when you break down the personnel cost, 46% of our personnel costs go to RRP. RRP is our research and recommendation program, which does the core business of the FST. And the 41% is the support services that your finance unit, your corporate services unit, those personnel went. And then 13% is the commissioner. Out of that 13%, two commissioners are full-time and the other seven are non-executive commissioners. And then when you look to our MTF allocation versus the requested funds in the previous year, you will see the trend there. In 2008-09, our allocations, and also 2009-10, it was 26.1 million. In the current financial year, our allocation has gone down to 24.7 million. And then going forward, those are the allocation 25.9, 27.5. Although we've made some requests in terms of more funding to fund the commission, also there have been some bilateral engagement that has been taking place between our stakeholders where our budget is allocated, which is National Treasury. Our commissioners have been taking initiative to engage them in terms of highlighting the major budgetary constraints that we're having. And there have been some positive engagement on those, but we are just hoping that with the new allocation there will be changes in those. Thanks, Chairperson.
Chair, thank you. Just in conclusion then, we hope that we have highlighted our achievements, but we really want to indicate that this is against the background of a lot of challenges. The major one that we have is in the area of human resources, where talent remains scarce, meaning that it's very difficult to get people who are qualified to do the kind of work we do. Even after we get them, we still have a high staff turnover, especially in the area or in the core business. And then in terms of finance, as that slide has just indicated, we have financial constraints, so that it's really not easy to develop internal skills. Even though we are doing that, it's not really very easy. So these constraints really affect our work in terms of breadth and depth. In other words, what we are saying is that we could do more if we had some resources. But we think we are still doing a lot despite the limited resources. In terms of human resource strategies, we do have policies in place and we do have staffing plans. So so there isn't that issue of much doom in terms of what we do, because we are in control and we are managing. We'd also like to highlight the fact that our information technology infrastructure is also really dated, and it needs to be replaced. And this is against the background of many acts that have been passed, or some very critical acts that require that our work year to year and year to year is increasing, because we need to comply. And also there's the issue of devolution of budget and associated accommodation charges. What is really happening is that there are things that we didn't do before. We did them, but we didn't pay for them directly, such as accommodation, for example, where we are now having to pay directly, but we're in a situation where money does not follow function. The CFO has just highlighted the issue of the cost of compliance, and that continues to increase, and it's one issue we don't have control over. I think we are about close to a million now in terms of those compliance issues. And also one area added, because our work, critical work, of course, is in the area of research, but it's also in the area of stakeholder engagement. For example, our presence here is in that area of stakeholder engagement. But the cost of travel is also high, but despite that, of course, our budget is very low in terms of that. We are having to constantly reprioritize and reprioritize
and we are actually even operating under austerity measures. But despite that, we are really stressed, and issues of deficit are hard to manage under this situation. But we know, for example, that we have a mandate to fulfill, and if we don't fulfill that mandate, we are also again going to be in trouble. So we are really in that kind of situation. We feel that a lot of these resource constraints have really the potential to undermine our effectiveness. The last slide mainly indicates trends in the allocation of funds starting around 2004. And we see, for example, this color. Okay. We have had a dip, really minus five, some 4 or 5 years ago. We are projecting some little improvement going forward, but that's also a bit difficult for us. But as I said, Chair, we are not portraying a dim picture, but we are just indicating that we are functioning under a lot of constraints. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Sitai. I also want to congratulate Dr. Sitai, DFSC, on the unqualified report and receipt from the Auditor General, putting an example to other state departments in South Africa and also then in provinces. In your document you tabled to this committee, Dr. Sitai, where you dealt with your recommendations, 2010-11. On page 5, last paragraph at the bottom, you mentioned the challenges in terms of the intergovernmental fiscal relations. It was a challenge. And I think that's one of the issues we will have to address. Looking what the Minister of Finance just said yesterday and this morning when we dealt with his presentation on the adjustment appropriation. You also mentioned your inputs regarding transport for in education and the quintile ranking. A serious issue that I'm picking up, and it's not only in my province, I believe it will be in other provinces as well, is transport of learners to sport activities after school hours in your poor communities. It's very expensive. To get the bus to take learners from Kamiskroon to Karkam, it's about 32 kilometers, and back 64. 900 rand. Those poor parents can't pay it. And if it's happening there, it's happening in the Eastern Cape, where you've got your people in the mountains, in KZN, all those difficult areas in terms of access. And this is the issue we will have to address, because it's going to be becoming bigger and bigger, the challenge. The other thing is about the quintile ranking. You made your recommendations, it was accepted. But in practice, you go to Pompeestad in the Francis Baard region in the Northern Cape, north of Kimberley. In Pompeestad, there's 10 schools. 8 is primary school. They've got different quintile rankings, but it's the same town. It's poor people living there. The same is happening in Namakwa. I'm talking on behalf of my province because I'm representing my province. Now, how do they get to that specific quota? And that must be reviewed, the implementation of that system. Yes. You mentioned your challenges in terms of your personnel. If I'm correct, there are 33 vacant posts. Well, it's higher. I think you must just address the committee. In terms of that, How do you see the SNC doing its work? Honourable members, I've started the questions on my left hand side. Honourable Sisi, Honourable Chani. First round. In that order, you may proceed, Honourable Mkhule.
Thanks, Chair. I would like to join you, Chair, in congratulating the Commission, the Chair of the Commission, on the work well done. But I'm having a slight problem. There was a new Chair slide number 7. They would be able to recommend to the government about the financing of healthcare, those like seven, those things there. But when you come to your slide number 10, from your challenges, I don't understand why you were silent, because you should have come there in order to achieve this, because you have achieved a lot. In order to continue achieving, I'm having X amount of people, I will need so much, they will cost so much. I need so many budgets. I'm having five type of budget. In order to achieve that, I will need so much. Come up with the whole breakdown and everything, so that the government will be able to assist you, because they're doing a well or a job, not a good work. If you definitely can come up with that, your work is steady, it's number one. Thanks.
Next week, when we will be having the hearing, departments will also make the input on the present adjustments appropriation. That's also a question that can be put in that meeting next week.
Mm-hmm.
When we do the hearing. Honorable Mokhisi?
Now, Chairperson, you just clarity. On the achievement, slide 11, where you mentioned the intervention on ESCOM, I'm not sure what intervention. Looking at the rise in percentage of the impending cost of electricity. And then also I just wanted to check your relationship with the HSRC and State South Africa with respect to recent.
Charlie.
Thank you, Chair. My first question would be, how much of your total revenue goes to personnel and how much goes to operating? Question number two, in terms of your employment equity, what is the current percentage in terms of staff, in terms of persons with disability? And if it's less than 2%, what is it that you are doing to reach that particular target? Number two, what is the real cost of this high staff turnover? Why are people leaving? Question number three. In your report, one has picked up that there is poor attendance of some of the commissioners to the meetings of the commission. How does that impact on the work of the commission? My feeling that you are being underfunded
although you are not coming out loudly on that, is that observation correct or not?
That would be me. And then the last question, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I must say thanks to Dr. Sistari and his team for the sterling report they have just placed before us. And I wish them, you know, to keep on doing the good things. Just got a small question, Chair. Small question, which I think I ask about that question sometimes back when we were meeting for the first time early this year. And the question was, what criteria does the Commission use in making recommendations for allocation? The answer I got, if my memory still serves me well, was that we are using, you know, headcount in terms of the population of the province. Well, I am not in, you know, arguing against that. However, I am saying, Mr. Chair, that there are other provinces which have a very low number of the people in the province, which will obviously disadvantage them to get a proper allocation. But however, there are other peculiar circumstances in those provinces. For instance, like the Northern Cape, which, if you just keep on recommending on the basis of headcount, then such provinces become very much disadvantaged. For instance, I make an example that when you live in the Northern Cape, if you go to the hospital, you stay in the Mapala, it will take you the whole day to reach the hospital in the province that can give you a better health service. I am saying, Chair, that the parents in the Northern Cape, if they have to send their children for tertiary education, they have to send them to other provinces. And most of the cases, these parents pay the fees of their children out of their own pocket. And I'm saying, when these children complete their studies, they don't come back to the province to come and give input here. They give an input to other provinces. Meaning, the parents of the Northern Cape are actually taking money out of their pockets to educate their children, for these children to go and give an input, a meaningful one, and then to other provinces. Now, this becomes a very serious concern to me, Chair. I'm seeing the children of parents who who stays in provinces where there is an institution of higher learning, you can send your child to that institution. But there's a greater possibility that your child can stay with you at home. And the child will travel a short distance in the first place. The child will come back to school and eat at home, share what you have as a family, where else it is not the case with the child of the northern case. You have to pay for the university fees, you have to pay for transport, you have to pay for accommodation, you have to pay for food, that of a separate item in your small budget. Now my argument would have been, if at all there was an opportunity for one to advance, there's many other things that I talk about, would have been, if the criteria of headcount the only manner in which recommendation can be made. If it is the only manner, then provinces like the Northern Cape is being disadvantaged. Or is there any possibility that any other criteria besides headcount can be used? And if that's the case, then I think it would be, Dr. Design, quite appropriate to think about the Northern Cape on the basis of other circumstances that exist in the Northern Cape, so that maybe the Northern Cape can get an equitable share in terms of the conditions existing there. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, Honourable Members, for the question.
I was just saying, Chairperson, that I appreciate what the Honorable McCall is saying. I'm saying if he can open the diamond mine that is closed, we will flock there.
Yeah, the good news is Transrex is making some more money than last year in the diamond industry at Honorable Day is going up. So there's something positive happening on the southern part of the west coast of the Northern Cape.
Right.
I think we must go there to pay an oversight visit there. That's in the light of note.
That's right.
Yes, Honorable McCord.
Chef, when you come to this matter, I know that you are the Jews, but I'm not joking.
Okay.
I'm talking seriously. Maybe Mr. Utsitsi is in a cosmopolitan city. Everything he can get at the stone throw.
No.
He can send his child to universities, so many around where he stays, and still stay with his child. I'm talking about issues that affect not only me, but parents in the Northern Cape. So you must not turn what I am saying from the serious point of view into a joke. Even the very mind that he's talking about, you will never find somebody from the Northern Cape owning a mine. It is people from other provinces who are owning mines. If you take all the mining companies that are in the Northern Cape, that originate from the Northern Cape, that produces so much. All their headquarters are based in Johannesburg. I can prove that. All their headquarters are based in Johannesburg. Now, why is it like that? It is a question of neglect. It is a question of really not balancing your acts, both from the government side as well as from the private sector side. There are areas in this country that but they are not poor. There are areas in this country that appear to be as if they are rich, whereas they are not rich, they are rich because of exploiting other areas. So I'm appealing to Honorable Mukhtizi to speak like a parliamentarian. I'm representing people here. I'm not here for my own personal things to kind of joke in a serious house like this. If you want to joke, you must joke.
I withdraw, Chairperson.
Thank you.
And my apologies to Honorable Mukhtizi.
I also take it was not personal meant, but the remark is withdrawn. Even TransX, the head office is in Belleville, in the Western Cape. But they're making their money in the Northern Cape. But that's an issue we will have to address as a province with the leadership of that mining company. Although Shatai, you are welcome to respond with the rest of your team.
Thanks, Chair. Maybe I'll start just by picking them up in the middle and the others I'll pass on to my colleague here. On the issue of vacancies, we are negotiating now with the Treasury. In fact, the process we are about to begin is to look at all the legislation that we must comply to and then revisit our mandate. And then on that basis, see how we take matters forward. But what has happened up to now is that we have looked at our mandate as it stands with a team that includes us, the Treasury, and the DPSA. And the conclusion actually was that not only are we underfunded, but we're also understaffed. So that the situation we are in now doesn't make it easy at all for us to meet our mandate. So we are working on that, but now, given the fact that we are in financial constraints and so forth, we really don't know what's going to happen. So this process started before the financial situation. But we are talking and we are hoping for the best, but we can always use some help here and there together to get over the hump, so to speak. But otherwise, then we are underfunded and we are understaffed. That is sort of the recognition that is there. But then, and then also otherwise, we can give the committee, I think as that they asked here, we can give the committee our personnel plan. That would actually indicate that we are saying we need a person here, a person there, a person there, and we don't have money here, we need money. Yeah, that detailed plan we can support to the committee we have. On the issue of relationship with HSRC, we don't necessarily have formal relationships where we have memoranda of understanding. We are working towards that. But at the moment, we do exchange information. Our researchers do go there to get information on whatever it is that is happening. In fact, our objective in the medium term is to have relationships with all the Chapter 9 institutions, which at the moment we actually don't have. But we just do interact. Our technical people do interact with some of them at that informal level. But we do want to formalize that situation. In fact, I think even yesterday I was talking to the Auditor General, we're talking about the fact that we need to meet very soon so that we can draw up on the MOUs as well with that kind of situation. So I would say, yes, we don't have formalized relationships, but we do have contact and we work together on certain issues. Then on the question of personnel and operating, we have Mabuso, what slide number is that? We have a slide number, slide number 18, I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
The Honorable Member wanted to know the between the personnel and management of what the potential of the management of the total number of the potential. The management of the potential of the regional work.
The personnel cost consists 58% of the budget that is allocated to the FFC. As you could see, this should be even higher than that, given that we are a human resource-based institution. Most of the resource that we use personnel to produce our final product, but it's still below us. It's just 58% of the budget. Some of the money also goes to the technical advisors that we use in terms of helping our research.
Thank you. On employment equity, I think I should ask our HR executive manager.
Thank you, Chair. In terms of the last report that we received from the Department of Labor, our performance in the context of employment equity was characterized as reasonable, right? But in the context of the employment of people with disabilities, at this present moment, we don't employ any people with disabilities. We have tried to use specialized recruitment agencies specifically for that purpose. But unfortunately, the last attempt that we made, was disastrous in the sense that the people we had invited for the interviews actually didn't turn up for the interviews. So at this particular point in time, we are not employing any people with disabilities, but the intent going forward, and the intent in the past has always been to take special steps to bring them into the organization.
On the issue of real cost of hires and turnover, I would like to say we employ young people generally, who have just been into the labor market, and most of them, the tendency is that they tend to say, "I'm going to get a better off where I'm going." There was a time when we tried to match. But then we decided that, no, we are not that kind of organization. So if a person says they want to leave, we let them leave. But what is interesting, though, is that those who actually leave, they come back. And now what we are debating among ourselves now is to say, must we let that happen? Should we just tell them that you left, goodbye, and But we at the moment are still a little bit considerate. They come back really talking about how wrong they were to have left the FFC. They talk about the development they were getting inside the organization, and that in fact they are not getting where they are. The actual effect again is that we tend to lose them to our competition. They go into government departments or they go to the treasury, and then when they get there, when they come back, they tell us that, no, there I was just pushing paper, and I realized that I was being developed in the wrong direction. The direction I wanted is to be a researcher, because my long-term objective in life is to be an advisor to people. And what I was getting there is not preparing me for that. So, we at the moment are very receptive to those kinds of things, but we are also aware of the risk, and the risk being that we don't want to just be used as a dumping test and so forth and so on. But otherwise, at the end of the day, that it is young people that we have, and they still think the grass is greener on the other side. Now, in terms of commissioners, the issue was then, really. We think, if I have to preempt our future interactions, I would say we have very good commissioners now who are actually interested in research. There are people who do research and so forth. So they attend, even at awkward times, at short notice, they are there. But there was a time when the mix was such that we had people who, would give preference to administration jobs. They were big bosses where they were, and they couldn't be, know, their jobs. But I don't think now it's definitely not a problem anymore. We have dedicated commissioners. So, right. I address the issue of funding, that yes, it is true that we are underfunded. I think we all know that. Now, in terms of Honorable Member Mokgoro, I will pass that question on to my colleague here, Bongani. And then also in terms of Quintal school funding to Bongani. And I think those are the ones that picked up. Thank you. You can add if there's anything.
Okay, I think let me start by saying the issue around the
learner transport. We did make a recommendation on learner transport in our recommendations for the 2008 Division of Revenue. I think that was in 2007, if I'm not mistaken. And the response from government then was to accept that recommendation. There's a lot of things that we suggested needed to happen, basically that involved defining which function it was, because we found that in certain provinces, it was the Department of Transport that was responsible. In other provinces, it was the Department of Education. And so there was no national legislation bringing it together, which would then have established certain norms and standards on how to actually do that. So you would pick up a few things from the Department of Education. And in fact, what I'm saying is that those were very... There was a policy vacuum at a national level to basically direct us. Now, in the process of preparing those recommendations, I am aware that there was a process underway between the Minister of Education and the then Minister of Transport at a very high level that was involved in trying to deal with that particular issue in view specifically. With addressing the problem of learner transport. I mean, we can talk the Northern Cape, we can talk, it's basically similar to across the provinces, as the chairperson says. Now, I think this is another area where maybe in highlighting some of the challenges we probably did not cover in our submission, that we table these recommendations and government responds and says we agree and all of that, and then so on. So in most cases, you don't see immediate action in terms of some of these things. Sometimes you see them maybe 5 or so years down the line. But there has to be some way of basically being able to track those kind of responses and see whether something has actually happened in that respect. And I think from the Commission's point of view, based on some discussions that we've had with the past committee, with the past select committee, it's probably not in the Commission's mandate to actually ensure that those recommendations which have been accepted are implemented, but that responsibility lies elsewhere. And I think it's a similar issue with the Northeast schools, because if one goes into these recommendations and goes into the Division of Revenue Bill, the relevant section that deals with the FFC's recommendations would be an annexure to the Division of Revenue Bill, and you find it all there in black and white. And then when it comes to implementation, you then don't see those things. You don't see those things happening. So it's something that I think needs to be addressed at a different level than at the Commission level. Certainly the responses are there. Now, with respect to the issue around electricity and what the Commission's call for an intervention was, the Commission basically has got some models that it uses to simulate some of these changes. That's an economy-wide model, basically, that simulates changes based on some social accounting matrices that go into that model.
and using your community surveys and all sorts of household information, you feed it into this model, and then you make certain adjustments based on what we think to be the demand for electricity and the profile across communities. You then look at the different impacts. It does show in that kind of modeling that, and maybe because of issues, reasons of access, your poorest of the poor basically use very little electricity. So when electricity prices increase, in terms of direct heating, direct impact, they are not the ones that feel the electricity prices, because most of them don't actually have access. That's the poorest of the poor that you generally your three basic services target those. But because you're also not looking only at the poorest of the poor, you're looking at expanding access to this, and if your expansion of access basically means that the more poor people access electricity, the higher the prices are that they must pay, then there must be some way of cushioning that. Now, in the current arrangement, your local government, your Kutebushe formula, has got a free basic electricity component, which basically is meant to subsidize municipalities in terms of providing free basic electricity. So in looking at what the impact would likely be of 100% increase in the price of electricity, and bearing in mind that this is work that was done in 2007, 2008 that I'm talking about here. In looking at that, you basically are faced with a situation where your electricity price increase will have an impact on the poor people and also on those new people to access electricity. Now, in designing a program that would actually cushion those people, you then have to look at how you deal with it through the intergovernmental transfer system, and that requires really looking at it in a more comprehensive way than we currently do, because the Kitebushe itself is just an allocation. So the formula just determines an allocation, and the decisions are basically taken by the municipality. And I think some of the commissioners, especially our commissioners that are nominated by local government, have got a far much deeper understanding of the kind of problems that municipalities are faced with when electricity prices increase, because you then find a lot of defaulters, and invariably the people that default are those that are at the lower end of the food chain, and therefore one needs to think about how to cushion those people from the escalation in the prices of electricity that one referred to. Some of these things required, at least from our perspective, required some follow-up work to be done together with the National Treasury and the Department of Minerals and Energy. I must say, Chairperson, that when we presented those recommendations, the DME was requested by the then Chairperson of the committee to make a separate submission, because they had prepared their submission on a completely wrong set of recommendations. So we did not get to see that input from them. All we saw was the response coming through from the Minister of Finance rather than from the department itself. And I don't know so from that. Now let me come back to the issue of the. For Honorable Mukoro, I think, let me say that we did have a chat about this, and one of my responses to you was to offer that we actually come to the Northern Cape as a commission, because this is an issue that I would assume that between the chairperson and yourself, and probably members of your committee in the Northern Cape, have had some discussions around. Now, at that particular point in time when we were discussing this, I did indicate to you that we were busy looking at a review of the provincial equitable share formula, and one of the requests that we had made from the provinces, provincial treasuries in particular, were reports that basically show us where it is that they think we need to adjust the formula so that it actually takes into consideration some of those areas where they feel that this is actually an issue that is specific to our province, that is not found in any other province. So that when we then sit down as a group with all the provincial treasuries and the FLC, and the national treasury, we can actually look at the different combinations and see how best one. Because it's always going to be a very difficult exercise, so long as you don't have anything that is actually in writing. I must say personally that as a person, I actually went to Kimberley in 2007 and had a discussion with the head of the provincial treasury around this matter. And we then had follow-up meetings that we held in Midland with all the provinces, and I think Northern Cape, in some of the meetings, were not represented. We did not get a written input from the Northern Cape. And for me, that is not to say that dealing with the government, the executive side of the Northern Cape, completes the picture. Also, dealing with the province, the legislature side, has also been a problem. I think when we met, I remember saying to you that the last time I remember going to speak to the legislature in the Northern Cape was about 2005, if I'm not mistaken. 2005. I don't think 2006 was. 2005. Okay. So it never been. Now, since Dr. Sitai has come in as chairperson, he's never been. I think it was in 2004. That was the last time that we have actually had an interaction with another case. And obviously there must be certain things that happen. So these are kind of issues that I think, as we discussed, because in this particular set of recommendations that we made this year, on the review of the equitable share formula, the arguments that are advanced, they basically take into consideration views from the different provinces and the different treasuries. And it would have made quite a significant difference, because the work is still ongoing. It would have made quite a difference if we had had the opportunity to meet with all provinces. And chairperson here, I must say that I did indicate to you as well when we first met that there are some provinces that actually have not been coming to the party. And as a result, some of these issues basically just fall by the wayside, because if they are not discussed at that level, they will not actually filter up. And so people responding to these things tend to be people that are sitting at the national level, and there's no input from the province. So we have not had that interaction with quite a number. I think if I ask the commission secretary, he'll tell me it's only about 3 on average, or out of 9 provinces that actually interface with the commission's recommendations since 2005. And for us, it's a significant challenge, because, you know, we will get these kinds of issues raised here, but when we really want the information that is specific to the province, that is documented, that we can then use and arrive at certain decisions, it becomes impossible to do that. I must say that though that there are provinces that have invited us after the discussions around the recommendations themselves, that have invited us to actually come back and speak to them again about the issue of the formula itself, because there are genuine concerns that affect those provinces. Free State is one of them, Gauteng is one of them, Northwest are the three provinces that have actually requested that we actually do this thing with them. And for me, so long as there's that exchange of information which we can then take back and internalize amongst ourselves, we'll be able then to deal with some of these issues. Because frankly speaking, when the formula was first introduced and the decision taken to use this people-based approach, the Northern Cape was an issue. There's a component in the formula that is called the institutional component, which basically tries to measure what it would cost the Northern Cape to run its institutions of government. So that basically means getting people to move from one area to the other. So that gets used as a benchmark for every other province. And so you get this amount of money. Obviously, in relative terms, it's quite a big discussion, because if you remove that institutional component, the Northern Cape loses quite a substantial amount of money. You lose quite a lot, so you basically make a lot of your money out of that institutional component. And so now, if we have to find something else that will replace that, it's something that will actually not make, it has to be something that will make you better off without making anybody else worse off. It's a complicated thing, because then we need to get everybody else specific circumstances and then sit in a room and agree on a certain. So I'm saying we agree with you fully, because at the moment the review of the formula, some of the numbers that we've been playing around with basically indicate that some of the indicators, the actual indicators, for example, if you look at the healthcare component, which looks at your proportion of people with medical aid versus those that don't have medical aid, it distorts quite a lot of things, because your medical aid, some people only have medical aid for a quarter of the year, they run out of the medical aid because of escalating medical costs, so you come back to the public hospital system, and we have not made an allocation for that. So that formula does not take into account those things. So these are issues that we must still put on the table. It benefits someone, obviously. Someone benefits. So if you remove it, there is a ripple effect. So it's important that we get input from everybody we interact with these things, and then we'll be able to internalize some of these issues. Thank you, Chair.
I think that covers so far.
Yes, thank you.
The last part of your response was very serious to me. We've got some homework to do as members representing our provinces. We just had only 3 out of the 9 provinces interacted with the FSC. Our job, any responsible Western guest? Not this year. We are under new administration, but it's our responsibility as we represent our provinces in the NCUP is to engage with our province and then to set up a meeting with the FSC in that specific province.
Mm-hmm.
Now tomorrow, the President will address the NCOP at 2 o'clock. Provincial delegations will be arriving tonight or tomorrow morning. The time is now then to interact tomorrow with our delegations and to put this on the agenda for them to take back and for us to follow up. From my side, I will interact tomorrow morning with the Premier of the Northern Cape. She's here. The Speaker of the Legislature will be here. The Acting Chair of Chairs will be here. So Honorable Mukhwaru, the table is set that we can push this thing forward. Because I'm ashamed that that province didn't come to the table for the past 2 years. Honorable Mukhwaru, you have I noted your hand. You wanted to say something.
Yeah, sure. Sure. Now because I was trying to get some clarity from the commission, but your summary before I ask the question sort of put what I wanted to ask aside. Because I wanted to get a specific answer from the commission. Is the commission saying that there is a possibility that the commission can sit and interact with the province as the province? Now, that being so, I don't say I would like to take this error. Just a suggestion that I would make. I want to take it further just with the leadership of the province. Government leaders of the province, possibly the treasury as well. But I'm just suggesting if it is possible for the commission to give me the response they've been giving me based on the explanations of commissioners, so that when I go to the province and speak to the leadership of the province, I should actually say we as a committee have been interacting with the commission and this is what the commission is saying. Because I could see from the explanation that part of it is the same there of the province itself. It's not like there is a commission. There is a possibility that the province can interact with the commission, persuade the commission to consider issues that the province can put on the table. Now, I say I want to take it up, but if the commission can just give me something that is on the basis of what the commissioner explained, I will have now a better, you know, a better approach to this. Thank you very much.
You may respond to that?
Thank you,
Chair. No, I just wanted the question of if, maybe by just reading this definition of the fiscal commission, you know, from this budget policy statement. In terms of who we are. It says it's an independent body that is established by the Constitution to make recommendations to Parliament and provincial legislatures about financial issues affecting the three spheres of government. So that it says also to provincial legislatures. So we are within our mandate, definitely, it's a direct mandate. You know. In the same way that we come here, we can do the same in any province, or if there's a nice province. Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. So I think we'll do that. What I was just pondering is we will have just deriving from this discussion. Yeah, in doing that, right. It shouldn't look like it was just voluntary on our part. It is a request from the committee. Yes, right. Can do it.
Seeing the background, Doctor, that you just gave us. And the deputy chair that the provinces have interacted with you 3 out of 9.
Yeah.
That's not good enough.
Right.
That's not good enough. It's only 30%. So from the side of this committee, yes, we will take this further. And as representatives from our provinces within the province, take it any further. And we will then, if I must say so, then facilitate these meetings to bring the stakeholders to the table. Because it's to the advantage of the provinces,
Are there any other questions, Honorable Makbule? Any other questions on this side? Nothing?
Right, Chair. The utilization of consultants. Since you are complaining about the constraint of the budget, don't you see that sometimes the I know you are all right, you hire them on different expertise, but if you become so serious that no, you used to money to have these people within your ranks so that they can reduce the expenditure, because when going through this thing very quickly, I find that plus minus 3 or 4 million or 2 million has been used for the services. And how can that be if you felt that we're going to the head hunt about these people to recruit them, hire them permanently, then it will definitely reduce the cost.
Thank you, Chair. In terms of that question, it's something that we have pondered before. But what it is that consultants will always be a permanent feature of the FFC, in that some of the issues that we address are just short-term, and we need that person just for that. If we employ him any longer, he becomes redundant very soon. So we are playing that balancing act to just make sure that we get them for that, and so forth.
Okay. Go ahead. Yeah, just to add something, I think one of the key problems that the Commission faces, as Dr. Sitai said earlier, is that you tend to get people that are very young. You playing at those levels, and you know the area that we work in, the area of intergovernmental fiscal relations, it's not even taught in universities in South Africa. So you're getting these young people, they come in, you must train them. When you train them, they become people that actually now are aware what is happening, and then because they interact with the government, different levels of government, and so they get moving. Now, in order to keep the work of the commission going as these people move back and forth, you basically have to be relying on technical expertise. These are the people that provide you also with the training or so-called capacity building, as it were. And unfortunately, in the year that we're looking at under review, which is basically here, we lost quite a number of our researchers who were almost at the senior end of the pile. And so we remained with the lower ones or very new ones so the turnaround time for a typical researcher at the FFC is about 3 years. At the end of 3 years, you find that they move. And so in order to continue being able to at least produce what we produce, we then fall back. The fallback position is these consultants that we have been using over time. So it becomes a very complicated thing. Now, in terms of headhunting and then trying to put people at the trade-off that you might want to make, but then you don't have succession planning, given the size of the budget that we have, your succession planning becomes very difficult, because you can have all experts on top there, and with the kind of budget that we have, it's very flexible, because it's just transfers direct from government, and that's what you get. So it's very difficult to actually juggle it in such a way that you reduce. You know, in certain years you might find that it goes down on your consultant, maybe because you've got projects that you are ripping up. But when you start new projects again, you must bring them in, and so it goes up. Yeah, okay. What also is included there are the costs for the Auditor General, which also has been escalating at a very fast rate. We basically trying to find a way of approaching the Accountant General's office to check, because our budget is very small, and to use 5% of it just to pay back to government does not really make sense.
And the fees we pay with that general are separate. I see the figures in the annual report, which is the auditor. Well, the budget council, where we sit once a quarter, is also a place to do that talking to the accountant general, where we also attend the meeting. Seeing the challenge you've got in terms of your personnel, and that there's not enough people in South Africa trained in intergovernmental relations. Most of the universities have a degree course in public management. It doesn't make sense that you study public management but you haven't got a course in intergovernmental fiscal relations. It must be part of the curriculum. Now, I know the professor at the University of the Free State. I'm going to ask him this question to take this further. You come from the Free State, so I did my public management course there. Are there any other quick follow-up questions? I believe not. Honourable members, we thank the SFC, Dr. Shatai and his team, for presenting the annual report. I think it's a good report. Seeing the input they make in South Africa regarding the spending or the trends, recommendations on the revenue. Thank you for that. Also forming part of the financial family, finance family, that's how we talk, and the finance team, because we work as a team. Seeing the exercise we had in Mpumalanga when we visited municipalities, and we also invited departments like National Treasury, Provincial Treasury, DWOF, Cooperative Governance, National and Provincially, ESCOM, SALGA, DBSA, AG's office. I wrote a letter to Dr. Shatai that I think it would be appropriate to invite the SFC to also be present when we engage with municipalities, especially on the spending of conditional grants. And if you go and look at the estimates, you'll see what conditional grants are going to municipalities. So we've got a lot of work to do in terms of our oversight for the next 13 months, because December and November is still there. Our oversight visit to the Northern Cape won't materialize this year. I spoke to the Deputy Secretary of Parliament, Mr. Mike Kutsia, and it seems to me committees will resume their meetings, activities from the 11th of January onwards, because the schools are opening on the 11th of January. And the NCP program and the school program goes in tandem. So we will work out an oversight visit to the Northern Cape that is close as can come to the State of the Nation address by the President next year. That we come here, do our oversight, come back and go on with our work, that we don't travel up and down between provinces and our home bases. Honourable members, our next meeting will then be on Friday morning 9:30 in room E305, where we'll be dealing with our reports. Anything you want to say? Nothing. With that, we come to the end of this meeting. Thank you again to the SFC. Thank you for your presence. This meeting stands adjourned. Thank you.